The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
John Harper in for Drew this afternoon, who is blessed with a number of our Relevant Radio listeners to be in the Holy Land in one of our very first Relevant Radio pilgrimages. Many more of those to come, so stay with us on Relevant Radio, and we'll tell you how you can be a part of future pilgrimages. Speaking of the future, anybody want more money? If you're on Social Security, you're going to get 8.7% more in your Social Security check starting in January of next year. That's the good news. The bad news is inflation is up again over 8%. So that average $141 that you're going to get in the beginning of next year probably will be eaten up. But we've got some more good news, bad news as we talk about inflation and really kind of how to navigate around that. That's coming up here in the next 10 minutes on the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. So often when we talk about issues of life here on Relevant Radio, of course, we talk about naturally life from the moment of conception until natural death. But for those unplanned pregnancies, you know, perhaps we should put a greater spotlight on adoption. How many children are adopted here in the United States? On average, that's about 135,000. So remember that number, 135,000, because it gives you perspective when we look at what's happened over the last couple of years based on the statistics available. Instead of an average of 135,000, that went down to 115,000. Just a few years ago. And then that number fell again to 95,306. Those are the number of children adopted in the United States. The last time we have statistics, and that's for the year of 2020. Let's talk about that with Terry Marcroft, who's the author of a book, Pro-Choice, Pro-Adoption. It's time for a loving, positive response to unplanned pregnancy. And the book is coming out next month in November in honor of National Adoption Month. And Terry's also the founder and runs Unplanned Good. Unplanned Good, that's a ministry to promote adoption over abortion. And you can find them online at unplannedgood.org. The website again, unplannedgood.org. Terry, welcome to Relevant Radio.
John, thank you so much for inviting me.
Might you know why those numbers on adoption are down so much, from an average of 135,000 now to 95,000?
They have decreased quite a bit over the last few years, and I have to just guess that it has to do with how socially acceptable both abortion and single parenting have become. Yeah, but you know, my numbers are even a little bit lower than that, because
really?
The numbers that you had probably include foster adoption.
That's correct,
and,
yes.
When you look just at newborn infant adoption, that means women who've chosen adoption for their unplanned pregnancy, that is more like 18,000 in this country. So it's really shockingly low. It's about 1% of the women facing unplanned pregnancy that choose adoption.
You know, when we talk about adoption, even though those numbers are small, and again, to put it in perspective, you don't realize that one in 35 children in the United States is adopted. That's a lot, or it seems like a lot. Maybe that's a better way to present this, is one in 35 children are adopted, and that's the aha instead of starting with the negative. And I apologize for starting with the negative. You know, it's funny how you can fall into that trap of the news cycle of starting with the negative instead of communicating the positive.
It is, right. And so, speaking of communicating the positive, there's a lot of recent information about adoption and how beautiful it can be for women who choose that as their own personal solution when facing an unplanned pregnancy, because adoption has changed so much over the last few decades that very few Americans really realize how it works today, but it can be a very beautiful solution.
And how does it work today? Because I would suppose if we asked somebody about adoption and their perceptions about adoption, they would see it as something that would be very complicated and something that might take a long time.
Complicated in a long time is one of the thoughts about that. And then a lot of people have some leftover anxiety and, negative feelings about the adoption that stems from the before the change. So it used to be in the 80s and 90s that when women placed their child for adoption, it often wasn't their choice. It was forced upon them. But things have changed very much in the last couple of decades. And now those days of closed adoption are practically over, thank God, almost over. And now what we embrace as the industry norm or the norm across the country is open adoption, which means that the pregnant woman, the birth mother, has a lot of options and a lot of decision-making power. And she actually gets to choose the parents. So that means all of the criteria that go along with what kind of parents she wants her baby to have. And it's a very intentional placement now, not something that was forced upon her. But all of that is so much healthier than the days of past eras.
As we talk about adoption, and again, the book is coming out next month in National Adoption mm-hmm. Month, and that is pro-choice, pro-adoption. It's time for a loving, positive response to unplanned pregnancy. And of course, so many resources that Terry Markroff had asked for you online at unplannedgood.org, unplannedgood.org. If we know someone who is in an unplanned pregnancy right now, how do we start that conversation? Because she's probably scared. And any mm-hmm. number of other things that we could add to that list. So how do you start the conversation about, you know, perhaps giving up this baby to adoption?
Well, we start the conversation, John, with a lot of compassion and empathy and a loving.
And that it's
a
positive option, too, right? It's a positive
yes.
option.
Yes.
That's the other thing. I'm bearing all the leads today. I'm sorry, Terry. Not doing a good job here.
No problem. But you're reflecting a lot of, you know, the gut reaction that we have today in the United States. But if we start with a compassionate and loving, you know, take her hand and sit down with her and take a breath and then look honestly and comprehensively at all of the options on the table, it would uncover the fact that, you know, it's really a media lie that says abortion is consequence-free or that single parenting is going to be easy, you know, because there's a lot of information about those two options that's coming to light now because we've been able to track the long-term effects of abortion on women and on their health, both, you know, emotional health, mental and physical health. So there's a lot of information we have now about the long-term effects of abortion, and there's also a lot of information we've been able to gather socially about single parent homes and how those might lead to challenging childhoods. And so when you put everything out on the table and you really are looking at the wealth of information that's available, adoption can look a whole lot more positive and beautiful than it ever has in the past. And so women sometimes are actually choosing it and then being grateful for that choice, being mm-hmm. happy with that choice and being proud of themselves down the road that they actually created a family. Because that can be a real beautiful thing.
Terry Markroff, as we talk about adoption, and next month is National Adoption Month, is a positive way to look at life for those women who are in unplanned pregnancies. I was astounded, number one, to read 1 in 35 children in the United States is adopted, but that 2 million, is it really 2 million couples in the United States are waiting to adopt a child?
Yes, that's the estimate of the main adoption groups. In the country, yes.
But only 18,000 infants are placed for adoption each year.
Right, exactly.
What happens to those other children? Or is it, of the 90-odd thousand that we were talking about, 18,000 of those are infants? I just want to make sure I have the numbers right because it really does give us perspective on this story.
Well, yes, and then you're starting with the numbers of adoptions, and if you start with the numbers of unplanned pregnancies, you're talking in the millions. And those, yeah. About half of them are aborted, and about half of them are raised by single parents.
Wow.
Whereas about 1% of them are placed for adoption by their birth mothers or birth fathers.
Well, I'm hopeful that we've given you some options if you know someone who's in an unplanned pregnancy in a way that you can start that conversation about how adoption is one that will address that. Those 2 million families across the United States, those 2 million couples who are looking to adopt a baby, and the fact that there are 18,000 infants, that's it, in terms of being up for adoption every single year. And I point you to Terry Markroff's website, which is unplannedgood.org, unplannedgood.org. Terry, thanks for shedding light on this for us today. Thanks for being here on Relevant Radio. Take care.
Thank you so much.
And God bless. That will be another intention tonight for the Family Rosary across America on this 105th anniversary of the Miracle of the Sun. Patrick Madrid, Father Rocky's special guest, along with you. So it's our family at Relevant Radio getting together with your family. And, of course, you can stream the Family Rosary across America from our Relevant Radio app right to your smart TV in high definition. So gather your family around the television and the smart speaker and pray the Family Rosary across America with Father Rocky and Patrick Madrid tonight at 7 o'clock Central Time here on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. All right, let's take a look at your money. And this is really kind of a good news, bad news thing about inflation. The Consumer Price Index showed that inflation in September was at 8.2%. That's compared to last year, and nearly everything is up. You know this, from groceries to gas prices, rent and utilities. That's kind of the bad news. But here's the better news. This is Alexis Christophorus from ABC News.
They're going to see the largest increase in monthly Social Security payments in decades, up 8.7%. We haven't seen that in many, many years. That's going to average about $141 more a month, and it couldn't come at a better time.
Now, is that really good news? Let's put it in perspective right now. Take a look at your money and kind of stretching your dollar as we go into a heating season where they say we'll be paying anywhere between 22 and 32% more to heat our homes, regardless of the modality that you have in your house. King Banyan is the dean of the School of Public Affairs at St. Cloud State University and an economics professor there as well. King, welcome back to Relevant Radio. Is this good news or bad news that we're getting 8.7% more if we get a Social Security check, given the inflation that you see?
Well, it's good news, I think, for those who are living on those Social Security checks. We obviously need an increase. As you point out, John, there's a significant increase in heating prices coming, food prices up. You talked about inflation already. The bad news side of that is Social Security is already said by the trustees of the trust fund to be running out of money sometime in 2033 or 2034 without congressional action. And an 8.7% increase was not what they expected or planned right. for. So this has the possibility of actually making the fund run out of money sooner, again, unless there's some congressional action.
Right, because the Consumer Price Index, for those of you who get Social Security, and I remember when my mom was getting Social Security, you know, she'd be thrilled. She would first complain, but still be thrilled at the same time. It's only 1.2% this year, but it was the cost of living, which was a lot different just 5 years ago, just 3 years ago, than this right. runaway inflation that we see today.
Right. Well, I mean, the plan that they had actually as late as June of this year was for an inflation adjustment that would run somewhere between 3.9 and 5.2%, which I thought already was kind of high, but also in June thought, well, that feels like it might not be enough. So better news for seniors right now who want that increase, that's fine. But it does highlight something that we've known is out there for a while, which is that as baby boomers age, this fund is going to run out of money and it's going to need to be addressed one way or another.
So we're coming to the top of the hill of the roller coaster, and you know that feeling that you get in the pit of your stomach when you drop down and gravity takes over on a roller coaster ride. And we're doing the same thing here as we get to the crest of this particular financial roller coaster. Now, the Fed is saying that they're going to increase interest rates by another 0.75 point when they meet next month. And we've also seen today that those who make between $30,000 and $100,000 a year, and that's a lot of families, King, in the United States in the last year are carrying more credit card debt than a year ago. Is this going to be the perfect storm of some kind of economic crash? Are we going to go into a recession, a depression here? Because all of this stuff doesn't seem to add up.
Well, I would caution listeners, John, to say I wouldn't go to the word of a crash. Is a recession coming? More likely than not, there's one. Yeah. Probably starting around now. Maybe it started a couple months ago. Maybe okay. it's going to start a couple months from now. That's certainly true. I think, though, that you point out something that's really interesting. When people got used to receiving additional money from the three different stimulus acts that happened in 2020 and 2021 to help us with the COVID pandemic, we started to get used to spending more money, and then prices went up. And one of the reasons why I think you see this increase in credit card debt is because the plans were made based on money they had in hand at the time, but a lot of that's just one-time money. And now you've made this plan perhaps to go on a vacation or to visit family, maybe to go overseas. And you made this plan and you've been waiting for years to take this trip because of COVID, and doggone it, you're not going to wait anymore. So you go ahead and open up the credit card and put the trip on the card and just sort of say, well, you know what? God will provide. I'll take care of this. This will get taken care of somehow. And you know, there is some reckoning that I think will happen with some folks as they recognize they've got a bill to pay and that money's no longer coming in.
888-914-9149 as we talk about your money today in the light of inflation. Yep, that's up again. Social Security, if you or a member of your family get that, it's going to be 8.7% more. On average, it's $141 per check, and you'll see that in January of 2023. Our conversation with King Banyan, who's the Dean of the School of Public Affairs at St. Cloud State University and an economics professor as well. We probably are, as you say, in the first throes of a recession. What are some of the things that we can do right now, of course, facing a heating season? And we see the prices at the pump and the prices for a chicken leg and a pound of hamburger meat in the store. What are the best ways to save money and spend less right now, especially, I know it's tough, going into the holidays and going into the beginning of the new year?
Yeah, I think the most important thing to do right now is to take a look at your current expenses and say which of these do I need to do right now, which of these can be delayed. Although I think one thing that's happening is people will expect that prices, some things that are happening, and what actually would be good for the economy right now is if people sort of said, well, these prices are too high, I'm going to wait till later when prices come down. The problem with inflation is we don't believe prices are going to go down. We believe prices are going to go up later, so we say we better get it now before the next price rise. If we stop that behavior, if we make a plan now to save more, that actually can help arrest the inflation right there on the spot. Okay. And so you're not just helping yourself in your own immediate situation. You're actually helping the economy more generally by pulling back some of that spending right now.
Hey, you know, maybe to have some extra money in my pocket when COVID first started. Yeah, I fell into that panic as well. So I cornered the market on cream of mushroom soup, which, you know, I can sell at fire sale prices. If you want to come by my house, Maggie will give you the telephone number and I'll be more than happy to unload some of that cream of mushroom soup. I think it's still good after a couple of years. Joe's in Passaic, New Jersey, listening to Relevant Radio 1430. Joe, do you get Social Security? You're looking forward to the increase?
Okay, that's a joke.
Yeah, that answers that question.
I started collecting Social Security when I was 62 years old. I figured, why wait? Who knows how long you're going to live? So now I'm 72. I started working part-time, and I just looked at my paycheck today, and they are still deducting Social Security from my paycheck, even though I'm collecting Social Security. They're also taking Medicare out of my paycheck.
Yep.
And I'm paying Medicare. And so I'm getting screwed. And then, excuse my French, I'm sorry. I'm getting not doing well there. And then I guess I'm going to get taxed on this too. So I'm not really getting anything from Social Security. I'm getting the bum's rush here.
Well, it's a good point to make that those who choose to continue to work longer after they start Social Security face the possibility of taxes, and indeed your Social Security payment depends on the state you live in. We said you're in New Jersey, right? Don't know the law there, but where I live here in Minnesota, they actually still tax your Social Security payment. You kind of get it either way. It's one of those things that I think if we think about that trust fund and needing to replace that, I think what's going to happen is the ability of folks younger than you and me. I'm actually past 62. You and I had that option to retire at 62. I think that option's going to get removed, and that's one of the ways in which we might help extend the money that's in the Social Security trust fund. I don't think there's any alternative but the fact that either benefits have to go down or some folks are going to have to pay more. And I actually don't think that problem is going to change anytime soon.
Joe, thanks for the question. Thanks for listening to Relevant Radio 1430. It's amazing. It's kind of like death by a thousand paper cuts. When you look at how money just kind of goes out the window in just kind of trimming down in the last year, I was realizing, oh, wait a minute. I didn't know that I had that digital subscription because it comes up in 6 months. And all of a sudden you see a charge on your credit card. And that thing, you know, you read newspapers online and things. And, you know, at the end of the day, and also cutting the cord on the cable, which is a lot of money, and doing something called an antenna on the house, I actually get more channels now than I did paying $150 a month on cable. I don't need to watch another home makeover show. Is that worth $150 a month? Maybe you'll like that channel, and there is some good stuff on HGTV. But you realize that, wait a minute, if I just simply take an inventory of what's going on in the house, suddenly there's $250 or $300 a month right to the bottom line. That's a lot of dough.
Yeah, I had to one day look at all the subscriptions I had on my phone. Now, because I use an Apple product, and I buy all of my subscriptions through the Apple TV and so forth, I could see them all listed out, and I looked at the number and looked at the bottom line. I'm like, oh my goodness, I didn't realize I was spending that much, and immediately turned a couple off. And you know, all of a sudden there's $20 here and $20 there. We cut the cord. Like 2.5 years ago, and I think a lot of people have done that. Yeah. But it's interesting, you know, the way in which subscription services keep you on the line, keep you paying that monthly fee. They don't make it terribly easy for you to switch out. So there are apps out there. There are websites that will help you look at what you're subscribed to and get you to consciously think about that. Maybe that's one of those things that you need to do. I used to do it like on New Year's Eve. That was, you know, I don't go out on New Year's Eve. I stay home and figure out how to save money for the next year. So that's when I did it last time. Maybe we need to just do that a little more often.
There you go. Yeah, because, you know, all of a sudden you're starring in your own show of who wants to spend like a millionaire, not who wants to be like a millionaire, right. Be a millionaire. So it's money that you don't think twice about, but when it adds up, or stopping to get that cup of coffee on the way to work, that could be another $20 a month, $20 a week in your pocket, or $25. And now that's $100. That's $1,200 a year. Think about that. That's half a mortgage payment, or if you don't have a big mortgage payment, that's a mortgage payment as well. And so you got to give all of this stuff perspective. And thanks for giving us this perspective as well. You made us feel a little bit better, and I'm glad to know that somebody else stays home on New Year's Eve. So, King, I'll probably call you as we go through our subscriptions next 31st of December. King Banyan is the Dean of the School of Public Affairs at St. Cloud State University and an economics professor there as well. Thanks for the perspective.
I appreciate it. Thank you, John. Good day.
Take care. And another quick reminder tonight, it's a very special edition of the Family Rosary Across America with Father Rocky and special guest Patrick Madrid. And that's tonight at 7 o'clock Central Time. And if you've not done it yet, you can actually stream the high-definition video to your smart TV. And there are so many pictures that we have seen of families praying the rosary around the smart TV along with Father Rocky. So that's tonight at 7 o'clock Central here on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app, and we're hopeful that we can plug into Drew by the end of the week. I know it's Thursday, so that means tomorrow, as he is on pilgrimage in the Holy Land with our Relevant Radio pilgrims. Looking forward to that here on the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
All the news and issues
now
that are happening now.
One place. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Now.
John in for Drew this afternoon here on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. Perhaps you were watching, as I was just a couple of Sundays ago, when Chuck Todd on Meet the Press had an interview, a sit down with Vice President Kamala Harris. And naturally, they got around to talking about Roe versus Wade and the Supreme Court reversing Roe versus Wade. And did you hear the vice president say this about the Supreme Court?
I think this is an activist court. It means that we had an established right for almost half a century, which is the right of women to make decisions about their own body as an extension of what we have decided to be the privacy rights to which all people are entitled. And this court took that constitutional right away. And we are suffering as a nation because of it.
Vice President Kamala Harris on Meet the Press just a couple of weeks ago. Of course, she's criticizing the Supreme Court's conservative majority, the decision in June, obviously, to reverse the 1973 Roe versus Wade ruling that established federal right to abortion. And that was during an interview with Chuck Todd. Thank you, NBC News, for that clip. Let's talk about this more with Rick Garnett, who is a professor of law at the University of Notre Dame School of Law, also the director of the Notre Dame Program on Church, State, and Society. Professor, welcome back to the Drew Mariani Show. It's good to have you on.
Yeah, thank you. Good to talk to you.
When you heard that, what was your reaction?
Well, so one hears things like that often. It's important to remember that nobody believes the Supreme Court should never overrule a past case, including Vice President Harris. I mean, I'm sure that she has a list of cases that she wishes the Supreme Court would overrule, and I'm sure she has a list of cases that she's glad the court did overrule.
Mm-hmm.
The question, so the term activist is one of these words that gets lobbed around but doesn't really have much content. I mean, the better question, it seems to me, was the Supreme Court correct when it created the right to abortion in Roe versus Wade 50 years ago, which we've been arguing about ever since? It's never been settled, contrary to what she suggested. And relatedly, was the Supreme Court correct this past summer in Dobbs to undo that decision and admit the past error and to give the issue back to the political process? Those are the discussions that are probably more helpful and interesting than, you know, throwing around these labels like activist. And to be clear, you know, over the history of our country, a lot of times conservatives have used that term to describe opinions that they don't like. I happen to be one of those folks who does believe that, generally speaking, judges should be restrained, that in a democracy, judges should be careful about interfering with the political process and should be inclined to defer. But, you know, by that measure, one of the most activist decisions ever was the Roe case, which basically took an issue away from politics, away from democracy. And here you and in that case, a court, you know, seven people just decided to take an issue over for themselves entirely. By some measures, the Dobbs case is an incredibly humble decision. If the justice is saying, this isn't our call, it's up to you to decide, that doesn't strike me as activist at all.
Mm-hmm. As we look at what's been happening in the Supreme Court, and of course, we're in our 24/7 news cycle, and the 24/7 news cycle personally for us is our own social media pages. So we're always quote unquote on. And we've talked about this. We've talked about this so many times. So the inevitable collision of politics and, if you're old enough, a pure Supreme Court. I think that perhaps was one of the, and I hope I don't have to refer to this in the past tense, you know, the purest of organizations, the Supreme Court. Has that been permanently sullied by the politics of Roe going forward?
Well, I hope not. I have seen some statements in the press and so on suggesting that that somehow the court, by deciding the Dobbs case, has undermined its own legitimacy or undermined its standing. I don't think that should be the case. I suppose that some politicians have an interest in undermining the court's standing because they disagree with the current court.
Mm-hmm.
In my view, one of the court decisions that most dramatically undermined the court's standing was, in fact, Roe versus Wade, because, again, it sort of concocted an abortion right out of very murky sources, and it removed an issue from democracy that people had been voting on for a long time. It is important for the court to be and to be perceived as a court of law and not merely a court of politics. That's a line that's hard for some people to draw, but I do think it's really important. And, you know, whether you're conservative or liberal or red or blue, you should not evaluate the court simply on the basis of whether it gives you the results you like. If you're doing that, you're not thinking about the court the right way. But in my view, the attacks on the court's legitimacy and the real danger to the court's legitimacy right now are coming more from Roe's defenders and from folks like Vice President Harris than they are from the court itself.
And also, in the context of this conversation, Professor, we saw what happened in the reality show that was the confirmation hearings for Brett Kavanaugh a couple of summers ago. And it's very hard to put that toothpaste back in the tube because an NBC News poll has showed that the Supreme Court favorability has gone to only 35%, especially. And this was taken after the Dobbs decision in June. And there's very little confidence. That same poll from NBC just 3 years earlier showed that it was 39%. So we've gone from 39 to 35, neither of which is a very high number.
Yeah, that's, as a lawyer, I find that disappointing. I guess like we might take some comfort that it's a lot higher than the confidence people have in Congress.
That's true.
But
that's some perspective and good spin too, by the way.
and I gotta say, I do think that a lot of this decline in the court's current sort of level of confidence that it inspires in the population is due to a pretty relentless media campaign to distort people's understanding of what the court is and what the court's work is. I mean, and I suppose, you know, complaining about media slant is the oldest complaint in the book, but I do think that often court's work is not accurately portrayed. The court's rulings are often described inaccurately in kind of histrionic terms. The issues that are actually before the court are inaccurately characterized. And so in fairness to our fellow citizens, a lot of them are being told things about the court that are not true.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, you are right that that's a number that's disappointing and disturbing. I mean, we know that confidence in institutions generally is going down with police, the armed forces, churches. We're in kind of an anti-institutional time. The Supreme Court is doing better than a lot of institutions, but obviously, as a law professor, I'd prefer to see them rating a little higher right now.
I hope
they will.
And you and I have been around long enough to see things become cyclical, especially in politics. Do you think this is going to turn around, or are we irreparably going in a direction that's going to lead us to not such a good place? And maybe we have to actually watch this disintegrate before we build it up again.
Well, I want to stay in my lane. I know a fair bit about law. I don't know much about politics or the grand trends of history. But my sense is that, as you put it, these things are cyclical and that it's a mistake to be too confident that things will continue along a straight line. There have been certainly times when the court was held in very low regard in our history and then times when it's been held in quite high regard. I don't think people should have an unrealistic or naive kind of infatuation with the court. The justices are human beings like everybody. They make mistakes. The concern I have is that, again, this idea is being created that if the court doesn't give me the results I like, it's doing something wrong.
Right.
And again, I think, you know, all across the spectrum, people make that mistake. The prime responsibility in our system of government for getting things right is with we the people. The job of the court, in my view, is to interpret the laws that we the people make. And if we enact laws that are good, the court might well give us good results. And if we enact laws that are bad, well, they might give us results we don't like so much. But we shouldn't evaluate their work just with this kind of, approval, disapproval rating.
Professor Rick Garnett is with us here on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. He's a professor of law at the University of Notre Dame, and he's also the director of the Notre Dame Program on Church, State, and Society, also teaching political science. And we're talking about, and maybe you saw this on Meet the Press just a couple of weeks ago, Vice President Harris calling the Supreme Court of the United States activist. And probably, as the professor has said, you know, we have put labels ourselves on the Supreme Court if there has been a decision that we have not agreed with. And of course, we have certainly seen the fallout from the reversal of Roe versus Wade and that vote happening in June. And that's something that is now impacting the midterm elections. I know your lane is law, but we were also talking about the fact that there are many candidates now that have reversed decidedly pro-life who are now kind of backing away on that, given the mindset of voters, especially women voters in the United States, about the issue of abortion. So there's a lot on the line for you and me as we go into the polls coming up for the midterm elections as well. But we also have to watch for the slippery slope. And I think we fall down it so many times, Professor, of judging. We're not supposed to judge others, but we've judged the judges. I mean, these are decent people. These are educated people. You don't get a nomination to the Supreme Court for nothing or for a political favor. They know their stuff. They're there for a reason. We have to remember that. And I'm just not carrying water for whatever party that you seem to align with based on your like or dislike of the Supreme Court.
Yeah, you are right that they are all able and talented and well-trained and dedicated folks. You know, some of them have views about the law that I think are wrong. But, you know, if you talk about, if you look across the full spectrum of folks who are involved in public service and, you know, civil service, I think the judges and justices in our system come across pretty well. I mean, lawyers are trained to think a certain way, and whether their policy preferences are left or right or liberal or Democrat or whatever, the training really is to try to see all sides of an argument and to treat a legal text as something to be interpreted, not something to be reinvented.
Right.
Now,
right.
Again, we can't, I mean, there's no getting around the fact that a lot of the court's decisions have political implications, that a lot of them involve issues that people care a lot about. It's totally understandable that confirmation hearings are controversial. Like you mentioned, Justice Kavanaugh's hearing, it's understandable because people care who's on the court, because they know that the court has many times in our history kind of inserted itself into these very controversial questions like abortion.
Right.
Justice Scalia used to always say that confirmation hearings would be a lot better if the court would just stay in its lane. But it was precisely because the court had sort of taken a grandiose view of its own role that regular people were like, well, I guess I really care who's on the court then.
But you mentioned Justice Scalia, and that's important and germane to this conversation that we're having, Professor Garnett, because if you read, and you can Google this, the relationship that Justice Scalia had with the late Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I mean, that's as opposite as you can possibly get on the court. But when you look at their relationship and how they discussed not only events of life, but you can imagine the robust conversations they had arguing cases back and forth and their points of view. That really is a snapshot of what the Supreme Court is, whether you like the folks there or not.
Yeah, I had the privilege of working up there for a year, and I was able to observe this. And you know, I wish all Americans could see it. The justices, even in these really divisive times that we're in now, are so much more collegial than you know, the folks in Congress, or for that matter, they're more collegial than a lot of us citizens sometimes are with people we disagree with.
That's true.
You know, you mentioned Justices Scalia and Ginsburg. They were genuine close friends. They didn't pretend to agree on everything. They didn't.
Right.
You know, Justice Clarence Thomas and Justice Stephen Breyer had a really fun friendship, and they, you know, obviously disagreed on a lot of matters. And sometimes I remind law students that even today, as divided as things are, even today, the justices agree most of the time. Not all the cases are these controversial 5-4 or 6-3 ones. Most of them are technical cases involving tricky interpretive issues about federal statutes. And, you know, a lot of the cases are unanimous or 8-1. And the justices and their spouses get together and just interact like regular people. So in a sense, I think the court as an institution should give us some hope that it's possible to have collegial relations with people who see things differently than you do.
Professor Rich Garnett with us, a professor of law at the University of Notre Dame School of Law, and also the director of Notre Dame's program on church, state, and society. We're taking you inside the Supreme Court, giving you some perspective in what has become a highly charged political conversation about the court, and I'm sure you've had that with your friends and family as well, and especially when Vice President Kamala Harris on Meet the Press on NBC just a couple of weeks ago labeling the court activist. We have time for your calls to join our conversation with the professor. Our number, 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. I'm kind of curious where you view the Supreme Court. We've heard that NBC News study and that only 35% favorability rating for the Supreme Court, and that's diminished 4% over the last few years. 888-914-9149. Your calls and our conversation with Professor Garnett continuing here on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Insight and analysis right here. It's the Drew Mariani Show. Relevant Radio.
The Relevant Radio studio line is sponsored by Catholic Order of Foresters, flexible premium life insurance. You know, for less than $12 a month, a 40-year-old can get $500,000 of coverage. Go to relevantradio.com/Forrester today. An Illinois Life Insurance Society, not available in all states.
Get informed and get connected. It's the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
John, in for Drew this afternoon. We're taking a look at the Supreme Court, especially in light of Vice President Kamala Harris's comments on Meet the Press a couple of Sundays ago, where she labeled the court activist. And of course, many labels have been flying back and forth. And that's really a part of our 24/7 news cycle, where everything does seem to get labeled and it does seem to stick. And especially according to party lines as well. I'm looking at some Pew research. This goes back to the beginning of the year. So this is post Roe versus Wade in the decision. And 84% of Americans in this Pew research study said the justices should not bring their political views into decisions. We're having a conversation about this with Professor Rick Garnett, who is with the university, is a professor of law at the University of Notre Dame and the director of Notre Dame's program on church, state, and society. Professor, should we avoid, and you've heard this so many times in news stories, of labeling the votes that come out of the decisions that come out of the Supreme Court as it was 6-3 conservative? Do we need the conservative and the liberal labels? The number is the most important number, 6-3. I mean, we can peel back the onion, but we always stick that other descriptor in there that politicizes whatever comes out of the Supreme Court.
I do have that concern. Although I suppose conservative versus liberal is better than when they label it Republican versus Democrat. Because that makes up. I mean, the justices do have different interpretive philosophies, and in most cases, those interpretive philosophies aren't of much interest to the public or to the newspapers, and they don't make much of a difference. And as you and I were discussing earlier, a lot of these cases are 9-0. But it is true that on some of these very charged, front burner cases, you can see a split among the justices that corresponds with their background. Philosophical orientation, and there's no getting around that. I mean, there are different ways to think about how a constitutional text should be read, and in our time, the two political parties have been, and this is true of both of them, have been looking for judges who have interpretive philosophies that they prefer. That's just the way it is. I've got a preference for how I think the right way to think of a constitution. Constitutional text is, but others disagree. But I do think it's a mistake to just reduce judicial behavior to as if it's exactly the same as what's going on in the House of Representatives. It isn't merely partisan, even if there are philosophical differences.
Andrew is joining our conversation in Nutley, New Jersey, listening to Relevant Radio 1430. Andrew, welcome to the Drew Mariani Show. You're on with Professor Garnett.
Okay, thank you for having me on. I want to point out two very fundamental things here at stake here. We're talking about the Supreme Court, basic fundamental human rights. And it's important for people to understand, human rights don't come from people. They come fundamentally from God, and our founding fathers knew that. The right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The key word is life. They come from God. And nobody has a right to take away somebody else's life. That is nobody's right. And for our president, to keep saying the same thing over and over again, that a woman has a right over her own body, she's wrong right off the bat, because we're not talking about her own body. We're talking about a separate and biologically distinct life.
Right, exactly, Andrew. You're a little off You're a little off topic here, Andrew. But I know exactly what you're talking about, and it is something that, into the bigger picture of what we're discussing here with the professor, is important. Janice is in La Crosse, Wisconsin, joining us here on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. Janice, good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon, John, and your guest sounds great. Oh, I am so happy. I love our Supreme Court. You can't tell I'm Catholic, pro-life, pro-traditional family. And we finally got this thing together, as far as I'm concerned. And hallelujah. And I wouldn't put much faith in these, what do you got, at CBS, NBC, or, you know, these, I don't trust these polls, you know, whatever they come up with. I mean, come on.
Why don't you trust them? You know, they're done by having had experience in research and knowing what goes into this in terms of the methodology why don't you? It's up to you not to trust them or not to trust them. But why don't you?
No, I don't trust them.
You don't trust them because you don't agree with them, but if you agreed with the numbers, then you would trust them. Am I correct?
No, because if it's a Pew Research, if they've been liberal, and every election, you know, Trump out of here, old, what is the name, Clinton way up, get out of here, wrong every time.
Okay, all right, all right. Thanks for adding to the conversation here today. And therein the difficulty, Professor, right? Because, you know, we've got, you know, everybody's entitled to their lane and their opinions, obviously. And, you know, and thanks be to God for, you know, this kind of conversation that we can have. But as long as we just keep our blinders on, we're never going to be able to move forward here, because it was only a couple of years ago, in fact, before Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death, there were a majority of Americans who thought the Supreme Court was middle of the road. So you can see where we've been, you know, and you can see where we've been in the last 2 years.
Yeah, although it's funny, these labels, they it's funny, they wax and wane. I mean, I can remember in the early to mid-90s when I was a law student, you know, you would have heard all kinds of people complaining about how, quote unquote, conservative the Supreme Court had become. And that was obviously a very different court than it is now. And then you had some, you know, very momentous decisions. For example, the Obergefell decision about same-sex marriage, which, you know, was decided by a supposedly conservative court, but obviously would seem to have more of a progressive result. So, you know, the labels wax and wane. I mean, I do think it is true that, as you've been saying, even if we think sometimes polls are inaccurate, that your basic point that there is in the country a pretty widespread sense that the court is becoming political. I regret that, but I do think it's happening. I think the Pew numbers are reliable. And so I think it doesn't make sense for us, those of us who care about institutional integrity, to run away from that. We need to think about what's causing it and, you know, what we can do to make it better.
What do your students say about what is your students' viewpoint on the courts and the political process that is a part of appointing Supreme Court judges? I don't know if you have the opportunity to talk about that in your classes at the University of Notre Dame, but over a period of time from when you were a student in the 90s until today, obviously the world has changed. How have the students changed on their outlook? Because we're looking at the next generations here.
Yeah, well, I'm blessed. I have at Notre Dame we get wonderful students, and you know they come from different places politically and in terms of their faith backgrounds and so on. But our students tend to be people who really do have open minds and who approach questions in good faith. So, I mean, I'm generalizing, obviously. I think my students, whether they're liberal or conservative, are inclined to give arguments the benefit of the doubt. I suspect they, on the one hand, they realize that, you know, debates about the Supreme Court are politicized. They do become partisan. They do matter in elections. They're not naive. They know that. But my sense is that most of my students, they do, they're here to learn how to think like lawyers, and they do believe that the court has an important role to play as a, as an interpretive legal body and not just as a junior varsity Congress.
I'm going to borrow that term. Let's get Mark in here. Mark, we've got about 45 seconds. You have the last word in Alvin, Texas. Welcome.
Oh, thanks a lot. Hey, I appreciate it. I hope I can get my thought across. But I'm pro-life, but besides the point that I'm pro-life, I'm also a businessman. I've been a businessman for 50 years. And when I honor a contract, I want that contract to be interpreted by the person that wrote that contract and what it means. It doesn't change. It should stay the same. And that's the way I think that the Constitution should be approached. Does that make sense? I get my idea?
If I can just jump in really quickly. I mean, I was talking earlier about different approaches to interpreting text, and the caller is exactly right that, you know, the theory that I think the majority of the court embraces now is exactly what the caller said, that we should think of the Constitution as being something like a contract that, you know, we the people entered into with each other, and we didn't, you might think, we might not want unelected judges to be able to change the terms of that contract that we negotiated and hashed out. Now, of course, we ratified the Constitution more than two centuries ago, but we've had the ability to update it through amendments. And, you know, the caller's really hit on one of the big differences in constitutional laws. Do we think it's the role of judges to update the Constitution,
right,
or do we think it's the role of judges to give it the meaning that it had when it was adopted?
And that will be our next conversation with Professor Rich Garnett from the University of Notre Dame, where he's a professor of law and the director of the Notre Dame Program on Church, State, and Society. Thanks for leading us in a great conversation. A lot to think about, Professor. God bless.
Yeah, thank you. My pleasure.
And something that's ancillary to this that we'll talk about in a couple of days is trusting what you see on television, and especially on the local news, which is actually outpacing the network news. We're going to go inside of that and give you the opportunity to speak with the decision makers. John, in for Drew this week, who's on vacation.